From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, a look at the Tea Party movement in 2012, but where has it gone?
The Tea Party was always going to be a phenomenon of a midterm election.
Plus, the story of Afghan war veteran Sam Brown.
We had an IED, and that was the beginning of a new life for me.
And how that life was made just a little easier with the help of a penguin and a snowman. Also, the first man to reach the $1 million mark on Kickstarter, a child of the British Empire takes on its defenders, and the Latin American hip-hop star Ana Tijoux.
La hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin was here in Washington last night. She came to speak at an annual conservative political gathering known as CPAC, and as she has the power to do, Palin brought the House down.
This November, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to fortify the House. Be aware, Washington. Tea Party patriots are alive and well.
So far, throughout the GOP primary contest, every major candidate at some point has tried to frame him or herself as the Tea Party's standard bearer.
I am grateful to what the Tea Party movement has done for this country.
So if the Tea Party is for keeping government small and spending down and helping us create jobs, then, hey, I'm for the Tea Party.
All the things the Tea Party movement is doing, which are constructive.
I think the Tea Party people are going to realize we need a clean, clear contrast.
I believe in a lot of what the Tea Party believes in.
The Tea Party put its stamp on the 2010 midterm election when the Republicans retook the House.
But who wants some tea? Apparently, a lot of people.
The winner is the Tea Party.
These people are literally changing the face of a party.
But what's been most striking about the movement this election has been its absence, and that's our cover story today. Where's the Tea Party? Chris Littleton is the founder of the Cincinnati Tea Party and co-founder of the Ohio Liberty Council. A reporter recently asked him about the state of the Tea Party.
And I said, the Tea Party's dead. And what I mean by that is that that protest idea is gone. It's long gone. And I say that's a good thing because the people who were leading those things, and I was one of those individuals, we understood that we had to leave that behind in its entirety. Protesting's not going to get you anywhere. Sharing your voice isn't going to get you anywhere. But tactical precision, well, that's kind of what ended up happening. And something very new, very different there. But the nomenclature that has become Tea Party as a pop culture name, I don't think that's around anymore.
You've been quoted as saying the most popular Tea Party candidate is not Romney.
Yeah.
Who is the not Romney?
Well, that's the undefined, and no one knows the answer to that question. The average Tea Party person on the street would rather have Romney than Obama, but every one of those people also understands that's still not fixing our problem.
But if the choice for you is between Romney and President Obama, you will vote for?
I personally, and this is me speaking for me and no other organization, I personally will not vote.
You'll just sit it out.
Yeah, or I'll vote for, you know, a third-party candidate or sit out. I want Obama out of office, of course. I just not thrilled with any of the candidates at this exact moment in time, so it's difficult to get behind any of them.
That's Chris Littleton. He's the founder of the Cincinnati Tea Party and the co-founder of the Ohio Liberty Council. Chris Littleton, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Now, many Tea Party activists acknowledge that the days of the big rallies may be on hold, but that their ideas are now very much front and center, especially on the local level. Here's Dawn Wildman. She's the national coordinator for the Tea Party Patriots.
There are people all over the country that are still working on bringing statesmen up through the farm team, you know, starting off with the local school boards and your supervisors and your city councils and your state government. You know, we're all feverishly working and doing things. I just don't think the focus is on us because it's so much about this presidential election.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the focus, you say, isn't on you because it's about the presidential election, but you would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your focus would be on the presidential election.
Not really.
Hmm.
I mean, and just from my own personal perspective, let me tell you why. You know, I don't have a dog in this race, and I think most of us understand there isn't this perfect conservative candidate, and I think people are really doing a lot more investigating, researching into these candidates than they've ever done before. People are really looking at everything.
I'm going to put you on the spot, and I know that you're not going to like this question, but let me ask you about Mitt Romney, okay? I'm not going to say he's the presumed nominee, but let's just say for a moment that he was the guy who was nominated by the Republican Party. Would you vote for him?
Yes.
You would. So if he was the guy that the party settled on, you'd be okay with that?
Yes.
But
here's also the caveat. Mm. Romney, to me, looks like it's a lateral shift in power, frankly.
What do you mean?
Well, I think he has, done some of the same types of policies in Massachusetts with Romney Care that the current president and administration has backed, and he doesn't seem to have a really strong conviction. He seems to change as the wind blows, and that's a lot like every politician we come across, and that means that very little changes. We better hope that we start bringing some of those people into Congress and into the Senate who really are conservative and really care about the fiscal health of the country.
It sounds like what you're saying is that Mitt Romney is a less bad version of President Obama.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
That's Dawn Wildman. She's a national coordinator for the Tea Party Patriots. Dawn, thanks so much.
Thanks, Guy.
But has the Tea Party already passed its prime? New York Times reporter Kate Zernike wrote a book about the Tea Party. It's called Boiling Mad, and she says the movement may have reached its peak of power in 2010.
The Tea Party was always going to be a phenomenon of a midterm election because midterm elections, as we know, have smaller voter turnout. They tend to attract people who are older and white, which those are the people who, by and large, made up the Tea Party. So midterm elections were sort of made for the Tea Party. And when you have smaller turnout, a small group like the Tea Party can have more of an influence. But the other thing is, in many ways, the Tea Party sort of overreached after the 2010 elections. They elected people to Congress. And a lot of people, at the time, 4 in 10 voters who went to the polls said they were Tea Party supporters. But the people who went to the polls and described themselves as Tea Party supporters really didn't know what the Tea Party stood for. So the Tea Party benefited in 2010 from people not really knowing much about it. Well, so what happens after the election is people started finding out what the Tea Party was going to look like because we had people in Congress who represented the Tea Party. And what did they stand for? They stood for obstruction. They stood for not compromising. And when pollsters went back to Tea Party voters and said, is this what you want? They said, no, we want people to compromise. So I think there was a little bit of buyer's remorse from people who considered themselves Tea Party supporters in 2010. After that, they said, no, in fact, we don't like the Tea Party anymore.
Okay, so if, as you say, the Tea Party was always going to be a midterm election phenomenon, why are the GOP nominees vying for Tea Party support, calling themselves the Tea Party candidate? I mean, every single candidate has said that to some extent.
Well, to a certain degree, I think that they gave the Tea Party more power than it really had. Remember how quickly the Tea Party came out of the blue.
Right.
In 2008, the enthusiasm gap very much benefited the Democrats. And the Republicans were really thinking, we're going to be in the wilderness for a long time because this just doesn't look good for us. What the Tea Party did, and quite suddenly, was flip the enthusiasm gap so that the enthusiasm was all on the Republican side. So what candidate wouldn't look at that and say, gee, I need me a piece of this? So there's this sense that you have to pay fealty to the Tea Party. But again, I don't think people are really quite certain about what the Tea Party means. So I'm sure Rick Santorum considers himself a Tea Party candidate. And certainly there are people in the Tea Party who care very much about social conservative issues. But it's not sort of the Tea Party vote as we've known it. It's proved to be more of the old conservative evangelical vote.
That's Kate Zernike. She's a national correspondent for The New York Times and author of a book on the Tea Party called Boiling Mad. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, last night at that CPAC convention I mentioned earlier, Sarah Palin repeated an argument many Republicans have made. A long, drawn-out primary battle will actually be good for the eventual GOP nominee. But has this primary fight been uglier than previous ones, so ugly it could actually hurt the nominee? I asked Lara Brown, assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, to think back to a primary as dirty as this one's been.
I think my favorite one to usually talk about is the 1976 primary. Reagan versus Ford. Ronald Reagan is sort of famous for talking about the 11th commandment and not going after Republicans. And yet he basically talked about how since Kissinger had been running sort of the country's foreign policy as Secretary of State, that America had declined. So for a Republican to attack another Republican in a way to allege that he was being unpatriotic or un-American is highly unlikely in today's moment.
He weakened Ford?
I think he did.
So you do not think that this current GOP presidential primaries any dirtier than previous ones?
No. I mean, you can go back to sort of Carter and Kennedy in 1980. And Teddy Kennedy is sort of out there without even an answer as to why he's running. And yet he has decided that for whatever reason, he is better than the person who's holding the Oval Office. And Carter immediately responded. He said, "I'll whip his ass." And that race lasted all the way to the convention.
All the way, yeah.
So this is the other piece that I would say about the race we're in right now. It's going to depend on whether or not Gingrich is going to stand by his pledge to go all the way to the convention.
Okay, this is what I've been hearing from GOP analysts for the past few months, that a long and drawn-out primary campaign will be good for the eventual nominee if it is, say, Mitt Romney, because he'll get battered, he'll get bruised now, but he emerges stronger for the general election. Do you think that's the case?
To be honest, this issue about divisive primaries is it's a much more nuanced and complicated issue. A lot has to do with what type of race it is and also whether or not the state of the parties are really reflective of the divisiveness or not. So, for instance, it's fine for both Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich to go at one another if they aren't fundamentally about factional coalitions within the parties who are never going to reunite. So do I think that this is going to be a nasty race? Yes, I think this is really going to be that. I also think that when you look at the current issues that are in play at the moment, we appear to be setting up a new culture war. Most people have thought that this election was going to be about the economy, but I think when you take a look at both sort of Rick Santorum's campaign and you look at the White House's new decision around the birth control, I believe that what is going on is that both parties are moving this election away from economic issues and toward the culture issues, which will drive out their bases.
That's Laura Brown, assistant professor of political science at Villanova in Philadelphia. For the troops injured in Iraq and Afghanistan, the deepest physical pain often comes much later, weeks or even months after the incident. That was the case for Sam Brown, who was badly burned in Afghanistan. But before we get there, some background. Sam graduated from West Point in 2006, and in the late summer heat of 2008...
Goodness. Yeah, we don't know hot like that.
He was deployed to southern Afghanistan to lead a platoon.
Deployment is sort of the pinnacle of service. In particular, combat is somewhat glamorized by Hollywood, and just it's considered a patriotic activity, something to be a part of. And I learned very quickly that it's not what it seems to be.
Much of what Sam's unit did was hearts and minds stuff, checking in on locals in Kandahar to see if they had adequate water, whether they were safe. It was hot, often mind-numbingly dull, and dusty.
We called it moon dust. It was just this kind of powdery dust that stuck to everything. No access to showers for a couple of weeks, at a time. And there were days where it peaked out at close to 130 degrees.
Now, before he deployed, Sam ran through a series of scenarios in his mind, scenarios of what might happen to him in Afghanistan.
Interestingly enough, the one drill I didn't run on myself was burning. And that just, for whatever reason, did not cross my mind as a potential type of casualty.
Sam's story is featured in the latest issue of GQ magazine.
I remember everything about the day I was injured.
That September day in 2008, Sam Brown's unit was called in to back up another platoon that came under attack. They were just approaching the site in Kandahar.
And we hit an IED right as we got to their location. And that was the beginning of a new life for me.
He's not knocked unconscious immediately.
That's journalist Jay Kirk, who wrote the article about Sam and reconstructed what happened that day.
He's on fire. He's down on his knees with his arms just flaming. His face is on fire. He's trying to put himself out, He's rolling around as much as he can, drop and roll. But he has a tactical vest on, so that's preventing him from putting himself out.
5 days later, Sam Brown was in the intensive care unit at the Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio. And almost immediately, to prevent skin infection, He was taken to a shower room where his skin was scrubbed by nurses. This is a regular, often daily part of burn care.
And it was as close to the same pain of being burned as I expect you could get. And it was a nightmare. And I thought, well, you know, when it was done, I thought, well, at least that's done. And the next morning, they woke me up and said they were going to do it again. And I wasn't prepared for that mentally.
He was put on a wide variety of drugs, including morphine, but nothing could dull the pain.
I mean, this is a drug that was invented in 1804, but there haven't really been a lot of advances in it since then. And there's a lot of really negative side effects to opioids. So, you know, there's nausea and constipation. It doesn't necessarily work on everyone. And then there's the tolerance level. So, you know, the more pain you're in, the more you need, the more you take, the greater the tolerance is, the less it works. And it's very dangerous.
2,200 miles away from San Antonio, two researchers at the University of Washington's Medical Center in Seattle were working with burn patients who, like Sam, weren't responding to pain medication. One of those researchers is David Patterson.
It takes a certain amount of attention to process pain, and if you're able to put that attention elsewhere, there's less attention to process pain, and consequently people will feel less pain.
Patterson and his colleague Hunter Hoffman were experimenting with virtual reality. Hoffman had been using a computer program with arachnophobes, a program where, by wearing special goggles, they become immersed in a world of friendly spiders. Patterson and Hoffman wondered whether a similar approach could work with burn patients. Here's Hunter Hoffman.
We created a world that was the antithesis of fire, the opposite of fire, a cool place, snowmen, pleasant images, just to try to do everything to keep them from thinking about fire.
They called it Snow World, and the Army was interested in trying it out with troops burned in battle, including Sam Brown.
I was quite skeptical. But I was also at a place where I was willing to try anything that might help.
That's because on a scale from 1 to 10, Sam's daily pain level often spiked at 8. So he put on the goggles and entered Snow World.
It was like watching a B-rated Pixar film.
Instantly, the world around him was populated with penguins and snowmen and woolly mammoths.
Everything about it was just cold and cool and cartoony.
And miraculously, being inside Snow World dramatically reduced the pain of his physical therapy.
Actually, they were able to move my arm and stretch it further than they had ever before to that point. And the pain was lower. So it was a very successful event.
Sam Brown spent more than a year undergoing surgery and in physical therapy. His face was reconstructed using harvested skin from his back. And during that time, he also fell in love. His dietitian, Amy, also an Army officer, is now his wife. And last September, almost 3 years to the day of his injury, they had a baby boy. His name is Roman.
I still, in my own mind, pictured myself for a long time as I was prior to the burn. But I'm at a place now where I picture myself as is, and the scars are really just a great reminder of who I am and the opportunity I've been given in life. It's sort of an external tribute or reminder to a new life.
Sam Brown's story is told by reporter Jay Kirk in the latest issue of GQ magazine. A couple of hours ago, we recorded history with an engineer named Casey Hopkins from Portland, Oregon. In 15 seconds, in 10 seconds, you will be a millionaire.
Well,
Casey and I were furiously refreshing a website called Kickstarter, where more than 12,000 people went to give him their money, $1.4 million of it. At 3 this afternoon, the funding became official. Here you go.
Boom.
You're good to go.
Pretty surreal.
Casey's the first person ever to collect $1 million from Kickstarter. It's a website that helps entrepreneurs fund their projects with help from donors. And for Casey, it all started when he got an idea to build a new, better iPhone dock, a little charger stand, because he didn't like any of the ones he found in the store.
They're these little plastic pucks, and they don't work if you have a case on your phone.
They stink. Those docks stink.
And they're so lightweight that when you go to grab it, the whole thing comes with it.
So Casey designed his own, one made of solid aircraft aluminum, and it doesn't move around when you take your iPhone out of it. He calls it the Elevation Dock, and he put his appeal on the Kickstarter site back in December.
Then it just exploded across the internet. We hit that $75,000 goal in 8 hours. In 24 hours, we had $168,000 in pre-orders.
People want this thing.
People want this thing, I guess, yeah.
Casey's received orders from retailers all over the world, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia. He's also promised an elevation dock to every person who contributed $59 to the project. And everyone else, well, they can buy one for about $90, but they'll have to wait until later this year. Well, Casey, I'm going to let you go because you don't have a whole lot of time. You got to make 15,000 docks, man.
That's right. Nose to the grindstone.
That's Casey Hopkins. He's the founder of Elevation Lab and the creator of the Elevation Dock. His idea raised $1.5 million on Kickstarter. Casey, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Kwasi Kwarteng is in some ways a child of the British Empire. His parents were born in Ghana when it was subject to British rule. They eventually emigrated to London, where Kwasi was born. He eventually ended up at the finest boarding school, Eton College, and then to Cambridge, where he studied classics. Kwarteng worshipped Margaret Thatcher as a boy, and today he's one of just four Afro-British members of Parliament who's a conservative. Now, in another era, Kwasi Kwarteng may have been the ideal British civil servant, sent to the colonies to administer the Queen's Empire. But Kwarteng is also an historian and one who's just written a scathing critique of that vast enterprise. It's called Ghosts of Empire, and in it, he focuses on six places the British administered, all places still coping with the aftermath of British rule.
If you look at Nigeria, where we've had flare-ups of religious conflict, we've had suicide bombings, we've had lots of people being killed.
This is Muslim-Christian.
That's a Muslim-Christian thing. But if you look at the actual geography, if you look at the map of Nigeria, you'll see that the Muslim area is in the north and the Christian area is predominantly in the south. This is reflects almost a tribal basis, if you like. And these problems essentially stem from the fact that the country is an artificial country. In fact, the term Nigeria appeared in a Times op-ed piece in 1897. So these artificial boundaries essentially set up a very tense situation in which different ethnic groups, different tribes were forced to come together where they had no real shared culture.
And we face those consequences to this day.
Absolutely.
You point to Kashmir, for example.
Well, Kashmir is a fascinating instance where the Hindu royal family was sold Kashmir in 1846.
Even though the majority of the population was Muslim.
Exactly, because this man, a man called Gulab Singh, had managed to ingratiate himself with the British. He'd managed to do well in the Sikh Empire, which controlled Kashmir previously. And the British didn't really want to rule Kashmir directly at that time. So they sold it to him. As a consequence of that, his family ruled Kashmir for 100 years. But when it came to independence, the Maharaja had the sole choice, and he decided as a Hindu to go with India. And of course that had massive consequences, which we still feel today.
I'm interested in your relationship with the story you write about, because of course you are the child of immigrants, right?
Your
parents are from Ghana, and you are in some ways are a product of some of these elite institutions that you're an Oxbridge kid and Harvard Kennedy School, and now you're a member of Parliament representing the Conservative Party, the party that many, I guess, would associate with tradition, these kinds of people that you write about. And I'm curious to get a sense of how you came to the Conservative Party.
I've really been drawn to the Conservative Party largely through Margaret Thatcher, the inspiration of Margaret Thatcher. And my conservatism is very much, if you like, an economic conservatism. I'm very much interested in free trade, in commerce, in wealth creation. In terms of empire, I think, if you look at the Conservatives' relationship to empire, yes, it is true. My family were probably victims, if you like, of a lot of the imperial tradition. But you know, we've moved a long time, I think, from that time.
Did you grow up, I mean, did you, when you were growing up, did your folks talk about how their worldview and the world in which they inhabited was shaped for good or ill by empire?
Yes, I think they did. My parents were born in the early 40s, so that's a very important date, because when Ghana, which was then called the Gold Coast, when it became independent in 1957, my parents were just finishing their high school. So that was a very formative age in which they were taught very largely by British teachers. And then as they left high school in the late 50s, the schools they attended became more Ghanaian in influence. So they were there right at the cusp. So obviously that shaped their views. And I heard a lot of stories about the old colonial times. I mean, my father remembers listening to the London Olympics in 1948 in his village on the radio. These kinds of memories were part of my experience growing up.
Those are complex memories, though, right? I mean, I've experienced this as well as an overseas correspondent, where you meet people who remember empire, and they remember things about it fondly, like your description of your father listening to the BBC. It's not just black and white.
It's not just black and white. Yeah. It's not exactly. I mean, this is what I'm trying to say, is that, yes, there was a lot of exploitation. But in a country like the Gold Coast, people often forget that there were very few colonial administrators. The British were trying to run, certainly after the war, the empire on the cheap. The hand of government, if you like, was quite light. So if you went to Accra, which is the capital, you might see a few British officials. But in the villages and the countryside, they were much rarer. So people very much got on with their lives, almost as if the British weren't there in some parts of the empire. Now, that doesn't say that it was a kind of land of milk and honey, and they did not feel that there was an alien force, if you like, in their country. But it does mean that some of the memories are quite fond.
I'm speaking with Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a conservative member of the British Parliament and the author of a new book called Ghosts of Empire. It's interesting because one of the main points you make is that democracy and the promotion of democracy cannot be exported. And you cite the example of Hong Kong, where you write about how this kind of parallel world of a British-style social hierarchy actually came about, not a liberal democracy. Can you describe
Absolutely.
That?
Britain was in Hong Kong from 1841 to 1997. That's 156 years. During most of that time, the first 140 years, democracy was a sideshow. And in fact, one governor tried to bring in a little bit of democracy after the Second World War. That was completely overturned. That was not a path on which Hong Kong, as far as the British were concerned, should develop. And that's, I think, a very good example in which empire, while it could have imposed law and order, which it did in Hong Kong, was not about spreading democratic values. And in fact, I quote a civil servant in Burma. He said, "Forget all this rubbish about democracy. We're not trying to make the average Burman into a Brit. We're not trying to bring them political consciousness. We're simply trying to make sure they get a square meal and that there's some kind of law and order." And that was very much what I think the empire in reality was about.
What about, I guess you could call it the Monty Python argument, right? The famous scene where it says, "What have the Romans done for us?" You know, roads, bridges, wine, so on. I mean, that's an argument that people like Neil Ferguson and others who say, you know, there are things about empire that gave us the world we live in today, and we should be grateful for that. What about that argument about infrastructure, about roads, about
obviously,
order?
Obviously. I mean, that's one of the points I make. I mean, I say that there was a degree of order, and yes, there was quite a bit of infrastructure development. What I'm arguing against is this idea that you could export some sort of political idea of democracy.
It seems to me that when you were writing this book, you had another empire in mind, and that is the so-called American empire. I mean, do you think that in some ways the United States and the way it operates overseas has learned lessons from the UK or has in some ways ignored them?
I think a bit of both. I think actually, sure, when I started writing the book, I was very much living under the influence of current events. The Iraq War, which started in 2003, had happened. We're still living with the consequences of that. And the whole notion of neoconservative ideas of exporting American values, that was on the political agenda. And my book was very much, if you like, a response to that. And I think given the drift of American policy in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly with the election of Obama, I think the Americans are now much less inclined to try and export their values in that aggressive way.
That's Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a historian and a conservative member of the British Parliament. His new book is called Ghosts of Empire. It's out now. Kwasi Kwarteng, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Time now for music and how the child of Chilean exiles became one of the biggest names in Latin American hip-hop. 1970. Nací un día de junio del año 77, planeta Mercurio y el año de la serpiente. This is the music of hip-hop artist Ana Tijoux. She was born in France in 1977 to parents who fled the repressive regime of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Ana and her parents went home after democracy returned to Chile in 1990. Her breakout record, 1977, which came out 2 years ago and what we're listening to now, was autobiographical. It was about dual identities and what she calls a life of shadowboxing against her parents' tormentors. Ana Tijoux's follow-up album is about the world today, about the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, and student demonstrations in Chile. The record's just out. It's called La Bala, or The Bullet.
The difference with this new album, La Bala, is like this is a conversation with the world.
What's the conversation that you're having with the world?
I mean, like, when I live in Chile, and of course with all those student protests and this parallel situation that is happening with Indignados in Spain or the crisis in Greece or Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Oakland.
You're watching Occupy Wall Street protests and the Arab Spring protests and protests, as you mentioned, in Chile and in Spain and in Greece. And you sort of connected the dots, and as many people have, and said something is going on in the world.
Totally, yes.
And it seems like you leap right into that world with the song La Bala, which in English means the bullet. La pistola lo miraba fijamente bajo el manto brillo cromo de su veneno. Disparo repentino penetró cada partícula del aire, luego se cayó. Se derramó la primera gota ya por la sien. Se derramó la primera gota ya por la sien. Se derramó la primera gota ya por la sien. Por la sien. La muerte.
It was almost like a storyboard in my head about a murderer of a kid. And the death dancing around this dead body, and the second verse is like the mother that finds his kid on the floor, and how the little angel begin to cry around the body. So it was super epic at the same time, which I never made it before.
The song La Bala, there's been some speculation that it was written inspired by an incident in Chile last year where a 16-year-old named Manuel Gutierrez Reynoso, a student, was killed by Chilean police during a protest. Is a song inspired in part by that incident?
After that, I made the song, like, it was not writing for somebody special. And then when Manuel Gutierrez is killed, I was thinking, this is the song for Manuel, which is, it was very crazy. And everybody was asking me, like, did you make the song for Manuel? I say, no, but I feel that it's crazy how it's fixed so well at the same time. It's his story. So perhaps it's an intuition, who knows?
That incident, and of course those protests, which became violent, came as quite a shock to many people in Chile who remember the violence of an earlier period, the violence that your parents experienced. As I mentioned before, you were born in France. Your parents fled Chile during the military dictatorship under General Augusto Pinochet. Did you see yourself as an exile as well?
I think that all the kids that are born like outside the country of the parents, I think that you always live with that duality. I used to speak Spanish, but not so well at the time. I used to have an accent. So I think that it's part of that construction of identity also, where you're trying to understand who you are, where you come from, but at the same time be very respectful about where you are living. Like, I mean, France offered exile to my parents, and I had an amazing friends and amazing education there also. So I think that with time has been more understood by myself.
It's interesting because you say you had an accent when you spoke Spanish when you were younger. And, of course, now you rap in Spanish. And have you ever thought about about making a record in French?
I've thought about it. But at the same time, like, I live in Chile and I feel that I'm still trying to understand this continent of South America, and I feel that I've got so much to learn about our people and our culture. And I mean, all the country in South America. I was just in Peru, Colombia, and Brazil, and every time it's like, wow, I've got to travel more, I've got to mix more with Latin American music, I've got to know more where we come from. So it's not that I don't want to rap in French, it's just that I'm just beginning to explore South America in all the sense. And at the same time, I've got to be honest, I love to rap in a language where I can go to Mexico and they understand me. I can go to Panama, to Bolivia, and they understand what I'm talking about.
I'm speaking with French-Chilean hip-hop artist Ana Tijoux. Her new record is called La Bala. Ana, we actually recently played the first single off your new record on this program, and the song is called Shock. Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos. Millones de polo a polo al son de un solo coro. Marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro. Tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro. No, la hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó, la hora sonó, del shock. La hora sonó. Now, the chorus repeats the words shock doctrine over and over again. Am I right in thinking that this song is related to the book by Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine?
Totally, yes. My father gave me the book, and I've got to think that I was super inspired by the book. Like, I feel that it was very clear, very explicative, like, about what happened in Chile, because she's talked basically about the doctrine of shock that has been installed in all the world with corporations.
It's a critique of capitalism, essentially.
Of course, and how it has been installed in Chile, like as a laboratory.
When you talk about the book Shock Doctrine and how, in your view, Chile has been kind of a laboratory, you know, a lot of people would say, wow, well, Chile is the most prosperous country in Latin America with the highest standards of living. But what is it that you see in your own country that you also sort of found in that book that disturbs you?
What disturbs me about this book, I think, is about the way that we are living. There is no logic in this system. There is no logic where, like, the poor is more and more poor, and poor in a way that is miserable. Like, we can talk about prosperity, because this segregation and this space between rich and poor are bigger and bigger. When you go to a ghetto in Oakland, or if you go to a ghetto in Chicago, or if you go to a favela in Brazil, or if you go in a población in Chile, the same situation happens, situation of poverty. And that's why you see the eyes of a kid of Oakland, or you see the eyes of a kid in a favela in Brazil, and they are the same eyes. The same eyes when you feel like, I can't be who I want to be. It's like there is no open door, there is no possibility. It's the story of South America. It's the story of all the ghettos of the world.
Ana, you are well known in Latin America. You've been around for a long time. You were in a rap group when you were younger, in the 1990s. You're now a mom. You've got a son. Does it change the way you kind of think of yourself as an artist and as an activist because you have this other part of your life that is presumably the most important part of your life?
I think it's the most beautiful place of revolution. When you got those conversation with your kid alone, with no camera, no music, you and your kid, this is the real place of revolution. Love-olution. Respirar para sacar la voz, despegar tan lejos como un águila veloz. Respirar un futuro esplendor, cobra más sentido si lo creamos los dos.
That's French-Chilean musician Ana Tijoux speaking to me from Santiago in Chile. Her new record is called La Bala, and it's out now. Ana Tijoux, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the interview and the good question. Tengo los bolsillos vacíos, los labios partidos, la piel con escama cada vez que miro hacia el vacío, las suelas gastadas, las manos atadas, la puerta de entrada siempre tuvo el cartel que dijo que estaba cerrada.
And for the week ending February 12th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Petra Mayer and edited by Mathoni Muturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Tasneem Shama, Megan Kane, and Kenya Young. Lauren Benishu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the program on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.
Estaban quebrados, el mirar encorvado, el puño cerrado. No tengo nada, pero nada suma en este charco. Mandíbula marcada, palabra preparada, cada letra afilada hasta la cresta de la oleada. Sin pena ni gloria, escribir esta historia. El tema no es caerse, levantarse es la victoria. Venir de vuelta, abrir la puerta, estar resuelta, estar alerta. Sacar la voz que estaba muerta y hacer la orquesta. Caminar, seguro, libre, sin temor, respirar. No rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz.
Haga lo que haga uno, estraga oportuno, tú no cobras lo que el tiempo paga. Se traga saga tras saga, raspa con su amarga espátula, huérfanos hace de brújula, su lúcida lenta en celo, blanca el arma, blanco el pelo, su blanca cara de crápula. Esta décima espinela, la que Violeta cantaba, la de la sílaba octava del payador, vieja escuela, y lo que duela, si es que tiene que doler, la flama sin calma que arder tenga, que así siga ardiendo, que siga fosforeciendo si tiene que florecer.
A colgar la copla que el viento mece, que pocas veces merece, cada pena en su altavoz, cada tos, pensando en sacar la voz. Oh.